As it sound like I'm going out there, but I swear it'll come back and make sense in a second. I think privilege escalation's a bit overrated.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
All right, guys. So we've had a pretty busy last few weeks. And I think that was often focused on RSA. So, I mean, look, RSA is one thing, but I think what's cool is it gives you a good backdrop to kind of see, kind of do a status check on the state of play of cyber. And coming out of it, I know there was a lot of discussion about, like, what did you see this year? What was new? I heard a lot of nothing stood out besides kind of AI washing.
Well, I think that's part of the challenge. When everything is AI, nothing is AI. Or it seems like there's no differentiation when everyone throws the same buzzwords at you. And that's fundamentally one of the challenges that we as practitioners have in trying to dissect what's happening in the vendor landscape. Everyone claims to do everything, and thereby we have no true understanding of what each company does.
Yeah, to me, it kind of seems like I don't know. I found this over and over again because I spent a lot of time trying to. I help VCs out a lot, and I kind of screen solutions, and it seems to me like a lot of what's getting pushed on us are kind of very niche, very specific point solutions that catch the eye of an investor or a few investors, and then once they've thrown some money in it, then there's this whole apparatus there to kind of validate the use case and convince the whole world that that's what they need. And then we get into this unhealthy cycle where, you know, these things are solving problems that aren't necessarily a big deal. So naturally, it's impossible to ever succeed there. So everything I see just seems so specific. It's hard to get too excited about it.
We're all founders as well. And going through this journey, it's interesting because I do understand that tension. I only have 10 seconds or 15 seconds with you, and I have to tell you what I'm doing. If I give you the big vision of what I'm trying to do, you're like, okay, what does that mean to me now? If I tell you the 5-second, 10-second version, you're like, okay, but that seems like a point product. So, you know, we have a limit. Just the span of time that we have to be able to deliver something becomes challenging as well.
You know, I've been doing this RSA conference since, I think, back to 1999. So I'm dating myself. And, you know, it's never been the big thing that you always expect. You do see a lot of friends, former colleagues as well. But there's always kind of a theme to these RSA conferences, right? There was the whole DLP, there was the insider programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a theme that I kind of connect that I noticed, and it was identity. And there was also identity and also non-human identity as well. And it seemed like besides AI, like Sunil was mentioning, there was this thing about identity and also non-human one identity as well. I feel like we're just repeating this stuff over and over. There's nothing new in security at the moment. And that's how I left the conference.
On the topic of identity, one thing that I think is why it feels like it's the same thing over and over again is because if you think about identity, we've always been having identity as a perimeter. Consider, for example, what is an IP address? It is a network identity. What's an API key? It's an application identity. What's a device certificate? That's a device identity. What's a hash? That's a data identity, right? So this whole notion of identity is already something that pervades how we think about controls within our ecosystem. What we're now doing is we're saying, oh, identity is a new thing, but it's always been the thing. Now we're trying to figure out how do we manage all these identities and use it for access control.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just reading something today about that and yeah. About zero trust in particular, right? And it was funny because I think we went from zero trust to identity-based. Everybody jumped on like, oh, that's what it actually means, because there was a long period where we all didn't know what the hell it meant. And then for a while, we're like, okay, we figured it out. Now it's identity. And as of, I think, this morning, it was, oh, by the way, it's not identity. It's behavioral, right? It's not who you say you are. It's what you're trying to do. And even if you're allowed to do 10 things, if you normally do 3 of them, then when you do the 4th through 10th, we should flag it. I'm not sure that's you know, that's super new or really predicated on the advent of zero trust myself.
I mean, I think identities continues to be a problem in that you see, you know, think about what things are available in the dark web. And these folks, these attackers are becoming better at what they're doing, more efficient. And, you know, you're on your laptop, you click on the wrong email, they install some password stealer on your browser, and they start, what they're doing now is harvesting names of popular SaaS companies or organizations. I don't think it's any different than before. It just so happens that some folks are really good at harvesting those usernames and credentials with the particular SaaS application, and then they sell it. And there are other groups that are coming in and saying, well, I'm going to be a specialist against this particular SaaS company. And if they nail that SaaS company or the users of those SaaS companies and make millions out of it, there's a herd approach of attackers. And that's what's happening. Some of these folks are, so there's always been harvesting identities and passwords. I think there's just a specialization in these groups, and it's all based on economics.
And one of to tie that back to zero trust, one of the ways we think about zero trust, the other way to think about zero trust is what gives you trustworthiness, okay? And it's those identities that actually give you trustworthiness. Each identity that's more strongly bounded to the user increases the degree of trustworthiness. As attackers find ways to compromise SaaS applications and to steal some attribute of identity, maybe tied to our browser, tied to our user accounts, username and passwords, whatever it might be, the level of assurance that that piece of identity gives us should notably decrease, right? What that means is to maintain a certain level of trustworthiness, we need more identities from other places. And this is where I think the whole non-human identity piece factors in. How do we grab other attributes of identity from other parts of our ecosystem, whether it's the device, whether it's the browser that we're using? And Jerry, to your point earlier, maybe it's even the behavioral aspects of what we're doing that factor into this notion of identity. And so each of these different attributes then contributes to increasing trustworthiness in a zero trust world.
Yeah, but you know, like what we're flirting with is multi-factor, right? This is kind of sounds like a replay of the old factors. It was, and I remember getting in an argument with the Monetary Authority of Singapore, right? Because they decided pretty early on, good on them, to force multi-factor. And initially in Singapore, it was for consumer facing banking, and they say, hey, you got to have MFA, and that was cool. I'm glad they did that, but. And I was a fan of it, but we were in financial market infrastructure, so it wasn't consumer facing, and it was a lot of B2B, and they weren't really ready for that, and they didn't really understand like systematic connections into a clearinghouse or that sort of thing. So it was hard to make them understand that. But what we did was we dropped IP address restriction. To your point, right? I mean, that's a factor. I think in your parlance, it's an identity of sort. And I say, yeah, well, in addition to credentials, we have IP address, and so we're multi-factor. And they didn't like it. You know, they blew it up at the end of the day. And they said, no, that's, you know, so they got into that old what you have versus what you know versus what you are and the stuff we were all trained on in the 90s on multi-factor, I think. But over time, it's funny. It kind of goes against what you're saying to a degree, but I don't think holistically. I don't think it's the multiple factors that matter so much as just having any one of them is worth a damn. Mm. Right? I mean, when we added MFA it did do a lot for the people who availed themselves of it. It wasn't because we had an extra factor. It wasn't like the password and that were essential. You could get rid of the password. Right? I remember arguing for a 4-digit PIN for the password and being like, hey, that's good enough. It's the one-time password. It gets burned. And then now we have man in the middle of it, so we got to go to the next level. But I think it's about finding one factor that actually matters.
You know, my biggest, I have to go back to this browser story. Okay. Like to me, and I think this is why you see, you know, Talon and the Islands and the Surfs of the world, right? Why they're becoming more popular, these enterprise browsers. But the problem is you go through all these stuff. Look, like for example, we went through that journey of MFA, and then MFA wasn't strong enough. You needed to do FIDO 2 as well, right? And you had to make sure that it was your laptop that was trusted before you can do any of these things, right? And they had to be part of the inventory, kind of the whole zero trust, MFA, FIDO 2, wonderful. but you authenticate, but these credentials get stored in your browser. And that the human being link clicks on the wrong thing again. I keep mentioning this, clicking on the wrong thing, or even worse, you get a phone call or a text and they, you think it's your IT department, or at least they're portraying themselves as your IT department, you click on the wrong thing. And these folks are just grabbing SAML authorized tokens, OAuth tokens, who now you can leverage those to connect to those SaaS applications, those applications. And there's, forget your zero trust, forget your MFA FIDO2. It's game over, right? Because once you have authenticated that token, that SaaS application doesn't really know that that token doesn't belong to that person anymore.
Yeah, I think that's the piece that people lose sight of, is that at the end of the day, no matter what, how many hoops you jump through to get in, you have to have a token that you ride. Right, and that has to be trusted, because you're not going to prompt for these factors.
No, you don't want to prompt the user for those tokens, but you absolutely can prompt the machine as many times as you want. And I would say, and that's essentially what the session tokens are doing, right? On the browser side, it's prompting for a token every time, but we need to find ways to then bridge that with, let me also check to make sure you're coming from an IP address that we know, or let's make sure that you're coming from a device that has a certificate that we know.
But I mean, just to add a little even more flavor to it, suppose you do see a suspect connection using a SAML token that's been authorized and authenticated. You go to your IDP, you tell your IDP, log off that user and force a re-login. Well, whatever that SaaS application that is trusting that IDP, that SaaS application gives you a session token, a session ID. So even though you force the IDP to, the user to reforce him to log into their IDP again, they still have that session ID on those SaaS applications. And that still is grant. So even if you force a re-login, the session ID is still active. And the problem is there's not a global enforcement today. There is, but people are not using it. SaaS applications are not using it with their IDPs, where you can do a global log off and force it on people. I think, Jerry, I don't know if I talked to you a long time ago when we were trying to be a customer, we were trying to earn your business. And I don't know if you brought that topic. I think it was you or somebody in that role. Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah, well, no, you know, it's funny. I don't remember it during working with you back then, but it makes sense. And I've run into it recently in that I was working with a customer who used a big IDP vendor to then get into all these other ecosystems. And you log into the IDP, and it's, you know, pretty diligent. It's going to have a fixed session length, all of that. But once you use that to log into email or Slack, those guys are alive for 30 days.
90 days in some cases. 90 days.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, sometimes I'd go back through the trail to get to email, and I would get run into the IDP, and it would ask me to log in. And I'd say, oh, shit, I went through the URL that bounced me around. Let me just go direct to email. Yep, sure enough, boom, straight in there. Right. And you know, I think that kind of brings up another point, though, is that, I'm not a fan of the crown jewels doctrine and all of that. Like, you know, there's a lot of people that say, well, the first thing is to figure out what you got to protect. I am a big fan of figuring out what you need to worry about, but I don't think it's necessarily an asset, like data-based. And I bring it back to this conversation because email is massive. Like, you know, people think that they, you know, you want to log into the systems and get into the database and do a SQL dump and all of that. But if you just have email, user context, no privilege escalation, if you're in the business of extorting people for sensitive conversations, they're in the email. Yeah.
And how many of us are using things like Google Docs? And they compromise your user credentials, and then a lot of us have more access to Google Docs than we should. And I'm not picking on Google. I'm not picking on Google, but it's how many companies know what the heck they have there? And then right? And then you can create an app. Once you have that authentication, then you can create a dummy application that's yours that use your credentials. So even though you terminate the employee, this application still has access to your Google Docs. So it brings it back to what you said, Jerry, that email still becomes a real problem. not just the crown jewels, but an entry and one that can keep you in that environment.
Yeah, I think another way to put it too is, as it sounds like I'm going out there, but I swear it'll come back and make sense in a second. I think privilege escalation is a bit overrated. And what I mean specifically is if you look at, like Mandiant stroke Google released a report on zero-day usage over the last X years, and it culminated in 23. They don't have data for 24 yet. And they were talking about the number, and I think ostensibly it was trying to draw trends, like are there more 0 days now? And people kind of reflect on that as the quality of software coming out. But in particular, it was on the exploitation of them. And so I was thinking, because look, 0 days manifest in us all mocking each other when we're doing a screen share, and you see the Chrome thing that says not updated. You know, and I hear security people all the time saying, oh, I can't stand it when I do that, and someone hasn't updated. It's so embarrassing. And I thought, well, how bad is it? You know, if you haven't updated, is that going to lead to ransomware? Is that how we're all getting known today or not? So the zero-day report from Google, as you might hope, talked about the 0 days in error in Chrome, which are the things that you're worried about when it says go ahead and update. And it said they're exploited. Now, okay, well, there's the answer. So I started going through each CVE and researching it, and most of them are privilege escalation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that means you're executing something locally on the machine already. And I think a lot of the world is spun up about, like, it's okay that an adversary is executing code on your machine. All we need to do is keep them from getting root on your machine. Yeah. And I don't get it. I mean, and not only to bringing it back, you don't need root. You need Mario.
Who cares about root, right? Who cares about root? Right? Who cares about admin? Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's not just over-permissioning. It's because you got your email.
For any vendors that are listening, if you're doing a vendor demo and you actually stop and tell the person, I'm sorry, my security guy is going to kill me because I have not updated my browser. Let me update my browser right now in the middle of my demo. And if you ever do that...
Has that happened to you?
Kudos to you.
Does that happen to you? So I'm arguing no. I want to see the vendor say, I haven't updated my browser because it's not really...
Neil, versus... Every vendor is going to tell you something is not going to patch their Chrome browser until they meet and they'll run it. Hey, wait a second. Sorry, I'm not being a good steward here. Let me do this.
Security culture. That's what it is, right?
No, that's right. But I do think that story is a big deal, though, because if you think about the number of protections that were sold that have to do with privilege escalation and that sort of thing, and I mean, Mario can put packets on his NIC, right? He can do layer 3, whatever that device can do, without root, without anything like that. You know? And he could probably log into more machines than the local admin on his computer or whatever it was anyway.
I generally agree on the privesc side. I think there's a lot of things that can happen just in the user context. What I found interesting with the document that you were referring to in the zero-day trends, I was actually expecting – there are a couple of things that I thought was notable, but I was also expecting more, especially given all the supply chain attacks that we've seen over the past, unfortunately, a couple of months now. I did note in the Google report, they mentioned – there were more enterprise-specific technologies that were being targeted. And I wonder if that is because attackers have gotten into the supply chain and are able to see things that we traditionally not have, that attackers would not have traditionally been able to have access to, things like their source code, things like their development pipelines, or you know whatever else it might be. And so this notion that enterprise-class technologies are being, we're finding more zero days within them, especially zero days in the wild, that's probably deeply concerning and maybe pointing back to the supply chain attacks we've seen in the past.
Let me start a controversial topic then on that matter. I don't know how many of us have done business in China or our companies are doing business in China, but I'm just going to make an over general statement here. Generally speaking, the Chinese agencies will mandate these vendors to provide them with the source code. Okay, so as you get more enterprises trying to earn business in China, and sometimes it's not like they're trying to work within, earn business in the China native companies. It's just international companies that maybe your clients are doing business in China and they're driving us there. That's basically you follow your clients. Well, if you start giving your source code to these Chinese agencies, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to start mapping what these enterprises are using and potentially say, oh, they're using open source. Oh, this is an open source package. Ah, let's see. It's a well-known open source package, but not a lot of contributors. It's kind of been kind of dead, but it's very in there in the weeds of all these enterprise companies. Well, let me go see if I can upload, become an author, start contributing, maybe make some changes, and there you go. So I don't want to blame this necessarily on the Chinese government, but it's interesting when we start having to be forced to give our source code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, tying that back to what Sunil was saying, in that report, right, you're talking about enterprise phones versus browser and that kind of thing. And, I mean, look, there's some of those that maybe, like, you know, PLCs and, like, backroom stuff and OT, and that's a different story. But on the ones that are kind of driving the narrative now, we got, like, MoveIt, Ivanti. But you don't have to be in the source code. You just buy the damn box. Right? If you get an Ivanti box, I think maybe even one of us with some downtime and the family away on vacation. God forbid we have AI. Right? We could crack into the things. And I can tell you, like, I played with a Ivanti compromise, right? I got involved in one of those. By the way, I don't mean to say I compromised it, right? I was working IR on that. And the thing that blew my mind is there was a moment in there where I remember saying, so the People's Liberation Army has shell on this box, but I'm not allowed to. Right? The customers are not allowed to have shell on the thing.
Wow.
And when I finally, and so we actually compromised the vulnerability that we had ourselves to triage the box because the vendor just wouldn't let you. And when I got on, my conclusion, and this is just my opinion, was that it was closed not because of commercial advantage and intellectual property and they were worried about people stealing. It's because it was just humiliating. You know, it was CGI scripts. It was straight up like, kind of like, remember Matt's scripts from 1996? It was like that, except they didn't get Matt's scripts. Instead, it was like Jerry scripts. It was really bad. So assuming that some adversary got a hold of their box and actually reversed it, or... I mean, I can tell you from the level of stuff I saw, I'm sure it was very easy to get, you know, put a keyboard and a monitor on the damn thing. Then I'm not surprised at all. And it wasn't because of open source stuff. In that case, it's closed source. It was just, you know, just awful there. So I think that kind of thing where these are the devices that when you reduce your attack surface, which is important, and you get rid of everything that doesn't really need internet, you're left with the VPN devices, you're left with remote access. And that's the end. That's always going to be there. So, of course, it makes sense to invest in figuring out how to pop those things. Yeah, and those do move me when I read the report. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, those are legit, those CVEs.
And the other thing I was expecting more of was more CVEs, especially in light of these tools like ChatGPT, which can do a decent job of reverse engineering. But also, the thing that helps... security researchers, or what makes a good security researcher good is their creativity. And these large language models are known for creativity. So my thought was that we would be seeing a lot more use of these large language models to help us find and discover new vulnerabilities. And so that's why I expected to see a sharp increase. And yes, while there was an increase between 2022 and 2023, with 2023 being the year of LLMs, it wasn't as dramatic as I expected.
Well, I mean, it could be, Sunil. Like, one of the things is if you're using these public LLMs, your one's company may not allow you to use your source code or upload your code or using these public LLMs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I meant that from an attacker standpoint. So I get a binary or I get something. I can use these LLMs to essentially... And if you saw, I don't know if you saw OpenAI's blog, Matt and team a couple of months ago posted about attackers actually doing this type of use case, and they can observe it, you know, obviously through what they're doing as well, which, by the way, may have its own problems.
So I'm with you on that as well, Sunil. I'd expect it more of that. I would agree, now that you clarify that.
Yeah. Hey, you know, that brings up a point to me, like, the AppSec in general, and I don't know if it, Mario, I don't know if you ever ran, you know, were subjected to in the soapbox I did where I talk about West Coast CISOs and the East Coast CISOs, and I'm clearly
West Coast rules on the West
Coast. but more important,
I think I'm just gonna put it out there.
Just go ahead and throw it out there. But I bet. Well, I bet you fall into the stereotype to some degree, which is not a negative one, meaning I think very shift left, right? Very code oriented, very and it's not about the West Coast, right? It's about the technology. It's about the company versus a bank. It's just different. But I do feel like the industry has pushed so much into AppSec that I meet a lot of security people, and they're good. I mean, they're much better than me in the weeds coding background. But their whole life is code. They're worried about their code security, and the whole universe of their board meeting down to their shopping cart is about SAST and DAST and SCA. And when I look at it, I think that's it's very expensive. Shifting left is, to me, extremely inefficient. A lot of false positives, fixing a lot of stuff that doesn't really need to be fixed. The IDEs popping up telling them to do something perfect. It's technically right, but who cares? Maybe this is a closed product. If you have a RCE in a binary that's talking to a database somewhere at the back of the stack, it's back to what we were talking about earlier. Like, by the time someone gets there, it's only a matter of time. These things aren't free. It's not like it's okay to fix everything. But if it's at the expense, if you're super focused on your code at the expense of your attack surface, I think that's dragging us in the wrong direction a lot.
That's an interesting position.
The diplomat.
I think it's important to shift left. I think that the problem is that a lot has been focused, as you're saying, just the actual code that you're developing, which is great. Please keep doing that. I can't stress that enough. But what's happening is there's a lot of movement of code that's being neglected. The actual underlying supporting actors, you know, think of your GitHubs, your GitLabs, your Jenkins, your Terraforms, things that are moving the code that somebody wrote. Even if your code is nice and clean, the supporting cast has been neglected. So you pop that supporting cast, in other words, GitHub administrator, a Jenkins administrator. Yeah. Yeah. GitHub, you change to somebody's doing Terraform because they're trying to automate things in the cloud. Well, all I need to go do is make some changes and get myself in there, and nobody's really paying attention. Because all the energy, and you're right, Jerry, all the energy is going on building good, secure code. And I think we need to, so I'm not going to say no to that. But it's kind of missing the other area that is, the supporting cast.
Yeah, the infrastructure.
That's exactly it. That's exactly
it. Is not getting the love and attention that it should.
Yeah, I work these types of risks, right? So first of all, a vulnerability to me is just a type of risk. I don't believe in vulnerability management as a department and titles and all of that. I think that's myopic, really. But I think a vulnerability is one of six types of risk. Code is one, another, and configuration is one. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that you're pivoting towards. And I think that's the underserved one. That's the one people are not paying enough attention to. And it's cheaper. I mean, it's impossible to fix configuration because the security people have to learn how to get along with ops and with engineering as you talk to them, and not just browbeat the engineers all the time. But in reality, it's a lot cheaper to fix configuration than to fix
the challenge, though,
code.
Is so far I'm actually struggling with the differentiation between code and vulnerability and configuration. But that's it. Let's just start with configuration versus vulnerability. There's a confusion around those two terms, because a misconfiguration is only a misconfiguration in context. The fact is that there's a configuration, and the fact that there is a configuration means that you can set it in many different ways, and there's not necessarily a right way, okay? But in the proper context, it may be a bad configuration. A vulnerability is bad regardless of context. It's bad. It's something that is a flaw in the system. Now, whether it's a vulnerability or a misconfiguration, whether or not we fix it is another level of context that's required. So let me restate that for just so it's clear. A configuration requires two levels of context to determine whether we should address it. First is it a misconfiguration? And then secondly, is it worth fixing? A vulnerability, we know it's bad to begin with, but is it worth fixing? It's only one level of context that's needed. Both misconfigurations and vulnerabilities both require additional context to know whether or not it should be fixed. Okay, mm-hmm. And that additional context is fundamentally the risk management decisions that we make. We're like, is this worth fixing? Is it, you know, going to cause other issues? Whatever else might be. So anyway, it's just a way to make sure that a lot of people confuse these words, and I just want to at least give some way to.
You know, it's interesting you say that. It reminds me of the evolution of engineers, system engineers, or network engineers, and the cloud. And I come from the cloud, so I'm always going to talk about cloud. It's kind of my world. But if you notice, before we had this cloud, before people started using public clouds, a lot of that was infrastructure you had to support. Jerry, I'm sure you had it. Sunil, you might have had it at some time as well. So you needed your network administrator, network engineers, you needed your rack, you need all that support. Folks, the administrators, in other words, but we offloaded that and outsourced it to the big cloud providers. Okay. And so all those, I mean, I don't know if you've seen, I don't know how many people are looking for network administrator jobs right now or posting jobs like that, honestly. Right. But we've lost some of that skill, that configuration, that stuff that was supporting that infrastructure. And we've lost it to, maybe Jerry's right, maybe we shifted left, focused a lot on applications, doing things, coding the right way, and all that talent's going there and missing some of the hygiene for things like in your code development life cycle and how things move. And that's not the sexy part.
Yeah. What I tried to do in this cyber defense matrix, for those who aren't familiar with it, one of the dimensions I have with the cyber defense matrix is 5 asset classes. Devices, applications, networks, data, and users. And part of the reason why I have that is to serve as an explicit reminder that my world is not just one of those dimensions. So what's interesting, Jerry, you mentioned earlier, the West Coast CISOs, well, they're largely software companies, right? And so what do they care about?
Yes,
application and data. Those are the two main parts of the cyber defense matrix that they spend a lot of time and energy on, and perhaps at the expense of device security, network security, and maybe even user security to some degree, right? And for me, the cyber defense matrix was a reminder to say, don't forget, all these are different aspects of what makes a secure environment, and we may choose to prioritize different things over the other, but let's just not forget that they exist. And certainly on the East Coast side, with banking and finance and other our regulators, don't let us forget that either. So it's something that is always front of mind.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's lessons to be learned from both, and the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. Kansas CISO is really kicking all the asses. And I know some out there, right? I visualize a spectrum of risk management approaches, with red teaming on one end of that spectrum and compliance on the other. And on the compliance end, we're thinking about frameworks, right? So I talk to a lot of companies that are kind of pre-CISO, right? They don't quite have a security team yet, certainly pre-GRC. And the default right now, because of third-party risk management and the questionnaire regimes, the default is very compliance-heavy. And it's which framework are you doing? Whichever one you pick has 389 things. All right, let's go. How many do you have done? Well, 300, that's a pretty good percentage. Pass to the next gate. And the problem is it takes forever to get through 400 things. And if the 399th is the one that's going to save you, well, then you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And there's room for that. I mean, I get it. If you're an examiner, you have to have a checklist. You have to start somewhere. At the other end of the spectrum, the red team, if you have a successful red team engagement, you might have 9 things that come out of that, not 400. And I would argue, especially if time is of the essence, start there, because you have to fix those 9 things. And you have a demonstrable use case when you're talking to the people that you're tasking with them. Why do I have to fix this again? Oh, because it's on the checklist. No, nobody moves for that. But we'll look at a screenshot someone dumped all of our data thanks to this. Oh, yeah, sorry, I got to leave the meeting. I got to go fix that. And on that end of the spectrum, I came up with this idea I've been doing in class, and it's one of the case studies, or at least it was the last semester for my class, and I call it a red team TTX, a tabletop red team exercise. And I came up with it because I'm so pro red teaming that I would tell all these companies with limited security budgets that they need a red team. And, you know, you go to one of the big shops, it's $25,000 to $40,000 a shot, and it's unreasonable. Now, deep down inside, I was thinking, well, there's a whole lot of stuff you can cut, people you could cut to free up this capital because they're not really doing anything. But I didn't want to go there. But I, to your point, Sunil, I realized you could hire the $40,000 red team to come in, or you got to get candid people that are really going to be honest about things, and they're business people. And you get them all in one room, and for an hour and a half, instead of just doing a tabletop where you pretend that this happened and have these injects, instead of one that says, hey, how would you break in?
Yeah.
I would call the help desk because you can just ask a sports team and you get three guesses. And you can't have the person in the room that goes, no, we're really good at that. Like, you know, everybody needs to be really self-critical, secure in their jobs, not fighting for their life all the time. And if you do that, then on the cheap, you could come up with that list of nine things that could get you owned tonight.
I think if anybody's hearing this, who's hearing the podcast when they hear it, is – Jerry is absolutely right. The red team activities is, depending again on the organization and how quality it is, it's really going to give you the biggest return, I think, more than what the compliance program's 400 controls are. I'm not saying you shouldn't use those controls, but the red team is going to show you and highlight those things are the low-hanging fruits that you got to go take care of. Because low-hanging fruits are the ones the attackers are going to go. The attackers are not going to go look for a fancy attack. They want to get in. They want to get in as quickly as possible, as effortless as possible, get your data out and make some money out of it, right? Or compromise your environment, et cetera. So I would wholeheartedly support the red team activity. I like what you said, Jerry, about maybe even doing a tabletop red team. Personally, when I talk to startups, and even when we were starting, very early on, we really stress on doing these red team reports and going deep and then being very transparent with your customers and showing them what was the good, what was the bad, and what was the ugly. And for the bad and the ugly, I want to see bad. By the way, I want to see bad and ugly on your report. If I'm not seeing bad and ugly, I'm going to think you're just trying to put a fast one on me. What I want to see with the bad and ugly is, what did you do? How did you react to that? And how long did it take you to prioritize those bad and uglies? And what did you do to fix them? And I want to see evidence of that. That to me is more important than any of these certificate compliance reports, et cetera.
Yeah. You know, I've been working, I have this, people that worked with me are sick of the same, you know, things that I always soapbox about. And some of them are visuals, you know, you know how it is. This stuff is hard to visualize and to quantify. And when you come up with something that works, you just like can't stop talking about it. And one of them is the notion of remediation agility. And my point there was that you want to see, at the same time, you want to see that that you're finding stuff. Like, you know, if you say we don't have any risk, that's a big red flag, right? I want to see, and if you haven't red teamed before the first time, they better go all the way, and they better have shown you the worst day in the world, because any company who hasn't done it yet, that has to be possible. And I want to see it. And to your point, I want to see those nine things. And I want to see that nine of them are closed or eight are closed. And the last one that requires a deep kill chain is 90% of the way closed pending X or whatever it's going to be. So in visualizing all that, what I ultimately said is like this graph where I want to see critical and high risk regularly. And again, that's what not just vulns, they're part of it, with configuration code. Maybe next episode we'll get into the difference in those, Sunil. But I want to see those being discovered with regularity and then remediated within the SLA. And the SLA is a whole big discussion, but I think people need to agree with that. And when the company keeps finding stuff and then can't, and then it goes into red, then we got a different story. And I recently came up, and with my team now, I've been kind of batting this around. I came up with this really cool metaphor that just is too damn unprofessional, and it's cholesterol. So for a board report, I came up with the notion of good cholesterol and bad. And the good cholesterol was the remediation. I mean, I'm sorry, the risk detection. Are you finding stuff regularly? I want to see that graph popping up and down every month, every quarter. And the bad cholesterol is those things that then go beyond the SLA and don't get fixed. And nothing, I haven't found anything that really grabs that people can grok that quickly, that board members can. That's the cholesterol, but it's just a little bit sloppy and off-putting in a board meeting to suddenly have this cholesterol jammed in the middle of a deck. But, you know, I think that's what it is. You want to see activity, right?
You know, I it's interesting. Last year for the RSA conference, 2023, I was at a government, White House, et cetera, kind of group, okay? And, you know, it was all about vulnerability management, the conversation or the meeting was. And the way this, and I don't want to say this is the government's position, I'm just saying he was a representative of the government in this space. And it wasn't the actual patching of the vulnerability that's important, but actually how a company thinks about identifying things first, how they prioritize. And Jerry mentioned this in some ways, how quickly they can remediate. What the government person was looking for is in vulnerabilities, was just how good is the company's processes for identifying problems, prioritizing them, and getting them done. It wasn't the patching that was important. It wasn't even the vulnerability management. Because they said that highlights more about the company. Yeah, Jerry.
It's a good start. Yeah, but you know, when you talk about that, I've seen people do that. So if you want to ask in an objective way, how good is a company's process, it's human nature, or maybe it's corporate nature, to try to be exhaustive, right? I mean, your default is you don't know the space, you're new to it. How do you find them all? How do you get perfect?
Yeah, and I don't think we're asking for perfection here.
I hope
I think it's really a question of given at some level, we were considered the central bank of the United States, at least certain Middle Eastern countries thought we were.
It's Bank of America, man. Anyway, it's the American bank.
So,
doing that public sector thing. Yes. Oh, yeah. It was Zions Bank was right next to you guys in the same crosshairs because of the same reason.
For those foreigners who are listening, we are not the Central Bank of the United States. Anyway, but some people thought we were. And so we were treated as a target that required additional levels of scrutiny and whatever else it might be. Yeah. I've described it this way. A lot of times we practice the we say the word cybersecurity, but I say most of what we do is cyber safety. Okay. What's the difference between safety and security? Well, you add the word food in front of it, and safety is like hygiene, compliance, inspections, and so on and so forth. Food security is something that's much different. It's around like starvation, it's food supply. But here's the thing. Who's in charge of food security? Usually the government. Who's in charge of food safety? Usually the owner of the systems, right? Who's in charge of keeping cybersecurity? You know, like how do we keep the, let's use the airplanes as an example. You have airplane safety and airspace security. Who's in charge of airspace security? The government. Should Boeing or should United be in charge of airspace security? Should they be able to dodge Russian and Chinese missiles? No. Okay. But if you're Lockheed Martin and you're building jets, yes, you should be able to dodge Russian and Chinese missiles. If you are Apple, I sure hope that you you see yourself as a Lockheed Martin because you're going to have Chinese missiles coming at you all the time, okay? If you're, you know, run-of-the-mill company, you probably won't get Chinese missiles thrown at you deliberately. You might get hit by one occasionally, you know,
during war.
Opportunistic standpoint, okay? But we were definitely in that category where we definitely got missiles thrown at us, right? And so we had to elevate our game. And in that regard, given the level of threat, we had to then consider controls that are equivalent to that level of threat. That's all I'm saying. If we weren't at that level, no. Authenticated scans and all the kind of stuff that you're talking about, that's a waste of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, getting back to the same point, the reason I mentioned like being exhaustive is the problem is that if people if the government wants to look at the private sector and say, how is everyone doing? To your point, Sunil, even though you guys were critical infrastructure and so on, the point was you were taking a risk-based approach. And the first step in that was different than for a small company. You know, when you figured out the threat model, it was different, and then it drove you into different directions and how much you're looking. But I'll tell you, there's a positive note here. Like I've noticed, especially outside the U.S., the Bank of England, the Dutch National Bank, now the EC, the regulators are doing a lot more risk-based. So I've seen, like, if you'll know CBEST, I know you'll know that, Sunil, and have gone through it. And I pushed back on the, and it's for anybody not familiar, it's regulatory-led red teaming. And I pushed back when I first heard about that. I was like, no way I'm going to have a regulator in here red teaming and all of that. And over the years, that was over 10 years ago, I came full circle on it. So this is the best thing ever. And it started with a threat analysis, right? And everything that was supposed to happen had to be informed by threat intelligence. Let's see that you studied the ecosystem, figured out what you need to be worried about, which is wonderful because it allows a company to say, look, we've looked at it and we're not really in the crosshairs here, so we're going to do a base level and still win. And other companies, they're like, hey, sorry, dude, I'm not going to let you get away with that, Sunil. You're kidding here. And it was third party and there was some independence involved. But once that was done, to then say, okay, so this is the scenario you need to be worried about. Let's see if it could happen. Of course, red teaming was the way to go on that. So whether you were massive or had a lower budget, you're still going towards having the nine things that you need to fix tonight, instead of just plowing through the checklist and saying, are you 90% or 80%?
Yeah, I like to think about the cholesterol thing you mentioned, and now this is yet another horrible analogy, okay? Horrible, horrible, horrible. Okay.
I'm telling you.
But let's say you're getting on a commuter plane and there's only one pilot, okay? And so the company is that plane, and the pilot are the administrators of that plane. It's a small company, small startup, whatever, right? And, you know, that pilot, they have high cholesterol, and they have high blood pressure up the wazoo. This person is going to fall on their face any minute. Okay, would you, as a passenger, choose to go and fly in that? You know, do you want to fly with that plane, that commuter plane, even if it's less costly, because you're taking a risk on your life, right? I think it's the same thing that I think when Jerry's talking about these nine really important ones, you want to quickly identify what those nine are and the really critical ones that weren't going to nail you quickly, and determine if you want to do business with that company. And the only way you're going to find that out is you're getting something like a really quality red team. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. As opposed to getting like the whole report where it tells me all the vital signs. Okay, my sugar level's okay. Maybe I need to eat less ice cream at night. I get it. Mm-hmm. But it ain't going to kill me. I'm not going to drop dead one day on the plane. Maybe I would, maybe not. Maybe you need more redundancy as well, right? Yes, yes.
All right. Well, great. Well, thanks, guys. We're just about wrapping out of time here, but this has been a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to doing a lot more of this. I think it's been great.